Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, the sibling podcast to the popular weekly title. I'm this week's host, Jesse Billington, and we're back after an unexpected hiatus. Things got a bit busy there for a couple of weeks, but I'm back and joined by features editor Chris Hope and content editor James Peen. Gents, how are we? And importantly, how are the classics?
Yeah, good. Have I talked about going to the Peak District? I know I've talked about the build-up to it, but have I actually had a chance to talk about it yet?
No, I think we mentioned the run-up to it, but I don't think we actually got around to talking about doing it, because we sort of skipped
a couple of episodes. My memory's like a sieve, much like the windscreen of the car. we went over to the Peak District, some mates of mine and I, and it probably wasn't the best idea to take the Mini, because the weather on Saturday was absolutely biblically appalling. I took a very much a stubborn approach of I'm doing this whether the weather's going to be terrible or not, without really not appreciating what I was getting myself in for, sort of thing. But it was good. It was fun. Saturday was a bit of a washout, literally, but Sunday was absolutely fantastic. We went over to Speedwell Cavern and obviously enjoyed sort of the driving roads around there. Got some fantastic photography. It was nice to actually spend some time driving the Mini. I've not been doing that much of it lately, so a proper adventure that I look forward to detailing in full to Classic Car readers in an upcoming issue.
Very fun. James?
Yeah, I was just talking about your Mini. I suppose it kind of puts force fuel to the fire of why people drive modern classics more and more. You know, 90s stuff, you know, it's a bit more usable, but then not part of the fun, is it, really?
I mean, the windscreen wipers stopped working, and even when they were working again, I didn't really see much of a benefit from it. I spent most of Saturday appearing as though I was attempting to reenact the steamy scene from the Titanic. It was pretty challenging driving conditions, and having a proper demister would have been a genuinely appreciated piece of tech, but it is what it is. If we push on, I had a microfiber cloth to dab the corners of the windscreen to stop it puddling on the shelf below. As I say, you know, it is what it is. I think everyone was quite jealous of me on the Sunday. They reckoned that I had the right car for when the weather was dry and I could sort of, you know, nip along these nice lanes and back roads and things like that. So, but yeah, on Saturday when visibility was poor and even with the working windscreen wipers, it wasn't much fun. So I was one of the few occasions where I was genuinely glad to just get out of the car and sort of know that I wasn't gonna have to get back in it again for another 8 hours at least until the morning. So
yeah, I mean, my planned weekend last weekend of working on the Beetle was ruined by the weather, so I don't really envy your experience. But yeah, I just stayed inside and had a cup of tea instead.
Yeah.
Yes, Storm Amy rolling through. Yeah, I'm trying to think when the last time we did the podcast, I think I'd just got the MG running, but I hadn't actually driven it anywhere. I think I'd had my mate Richard come round and work. No, we hadn't even got that far. Yeah, so it's been a busy missing few weeks for the MG, really. So before going to Revival, a mate of mine came round, worked his magic on the MG, got it started up. Didn't take it to Revival in the end. I left it home, so sort of a few other bits I wanted to chase out the system, just get it all sort of properly set up and running. While at Revival, spoke to the PR chap for Berlin, which is the sort of overarching company that owns SU, AML, a bunch of other carbs, as well as Austin Cars, interesting enough. He said, oh, if you need any parts, drop me a line, we can get those sorted out. So immediately in the back of my head, I go, ooh, I could get some little performance intakes for the carburettors, have a look on their website, spot the very nice billet steel ones. I'm like, yeah, I'll have two of those, please. So to their credit, Berlin got those turned around, sent over. They arrived not last Friday, Friday before, just as I was leaving to head up to Sheffield to go see McFly versus Buster in concert. That's an aside. but I'd already dropped the car off at my mate's again to put it on his rolling road. So he's Richard Woolmer, part of Woolmer Classic Engineering. They do a lot of race car setups, race car maintenance builds and everything. And he said, I'll be able to squeeze it on the rolling road one evening. So dropped off at his in the week, dropped off the new parts at his. He fitted the little trumpets to the carburettors, stuck it on the rolling road, and we are making, I do have the sort of numbers jotted down here. Here we go. It is 67 horsepower at the wheels, 80 at the flywheel, 87 pound-foot of torque at the wheels, and 100 at the flywheel. And we've got a dead flat torque curve from 1,000 RPM right the way through to 4,000 RPM with power good till 4,700, which isn't bad for a car that weighs a fraction over 700 kilos. And that's a very conservative tune as well, because the exhaust doesn't run hot enough to get a good pro breeding for the oxygen mix. So we're going to try and get it before the NEC back to Richards, weld in a proper O2 sensor into the exhaust that we can plug into the rolling road and get an even better tune out of it. So we might be able to push 70 brake horsepower at the wheels is the end goal here. So which is sort of that magic, was it 100 horsepower per ton at that point?
You're outlining this to a Mini owner and a Beetle owner. I mean, these figs are quite impressive, aren't they? So
it's the torque dream of.
Yeah, it's the torque you really notice in that, because it properly bowls along. Picked it up from his Sunday morning, and then drove it straight from his, still covered in all the dust and dirt it accumulated after a year in my workshop, straight over to Bicester for the scramble as well. So I sort of parked it up on the lawn at Bicester for the first time it had been there since October 2023, which tells you just how long this has been coming. So yeah, it was nice to get it back out and enjoy it, and it sounds incredible. Now that it's got a proper little induction snarl to it as well, it's really breathing quite happily. And yeah, bowls along. I was heading out of Milton Keynes in the direction of Bicester and joined a convoy of an R33 Skyline and a Porsche 924. And the 924 owner pulled up next to me when we got to Bicester and said, "Gets off roundabouts quickly, that." And I was like, "Yeah, it's until you run out of gears as you get it into fourth, at which point all of a sudden sort of the Porsche had the legs." But he was like, "It's pretty nippy." I was like, "Yeah, it's a good bit of fun." So yeah, I've had a great bit of time with that, and got it cleaned up when I got it home from Bicester. Been going over it with the polish, re-blacking in the bumpers, cleaning the glass so I can actually see out the windscreen now. So yeah, that's all finally coming together as sort of a, I won't say a completed project. A classic car is never a completed project. I mean, just simply something waiting for the next thing to happen. But yeah, we're in a good place at the moment. So yeah, it's been great times when it comes to my MG, at least.
Big milestone passed. And yeah, the missing fifth gear is definitely something that I still sort of notice as well. You just can't help yourself, sort of thing. It's like, yeah, it sounds like I should be changing up. Oh wait, no, there's nothing for me to change up into. So
yeah, you get to a highway cruising speed, you look at the tach and go, okay, maybe select a more classic appropriate highway cruising speed. It's just yelling at me if I'm sort of sat at conventional modern car dual carriageway speeds. But yeah, it's, you can get a 5-speed gearbox that fits in the MG Midget, but we'll see what budgets allow for in 2026, though. I'm sure my girlfriend would rather I spend that money looking at somewhere to live that isn't my parents' house instead of gearboxes and new engines. But anyway, that's by the by. We'll jump into some sort of discussions around the current issue that we've got out, the 8th of October issue. We're actually recording this on the day that it arrives on shop shelves and doormats. And we'll start with the lead news story, which is a bigger push for apprenticeships. James, this is one that you sort of dug up and followed.
Yeah, this is one that came about from the Labour Party's conference in Liverpool on the 30th of September, I believe. Basically, Keir Starmer, or Sir Keir, I should call him, probably, has gone back on Tony Blair's ambition in 1999 to get 50% of kids into uni. Apparently, that's no longer fit for our times, which I suppose we do all kind of agree with, especially trying to put kids through university these days. But basically, the plan is to get more kids into doing apprenticeships, which should only be a good thing for our industry, I believe we are all agreed on. But we spoke to a number of different industry experts to see what they thought about it, and they all kind of agreed that it's a good thing. It just depends really what the detail is when it all comes to fruition. Because I believe, what was the term? A gold standard apprenticeship, which apparently there is no sort of clarity on what that would actually entail at the moment.
I think the industry, it's always crying out for sort of properly skilled people when it comes to very hands-on tasks. And I certainly agree with the argument that maybe the push for university places is now a bit sort of outdated or no longer in keeping with what sort of the UK society needs. And certainly when it comes to the classic society, it's all very well having the theory of these things learned, but there's certainly an argument for being able to do the practical application and sort of being taught and learning those important skills.
I think it'd be useful to normalize apprenticeships. I think a lot of the problems that we've sort of encountered with regards to the skills gap, as it's sort of been described, whereby we're not able to sort of replace skilled technicians who are coming up for retirement age with replacements. A lot of it comes down to the fact that a lot of these specialists don't have huge staffs. You know, you're talking like a handful of people, maybe even some of them are sort of, you know, one-man bands. It's a huge risk from their point of view to take on an apprentice, to train them, to give them those placements. It's taking sort of time out of their working week to sort of, you know, get them where they need to be, sort of thing. So I think from my point of view, just the idea of normalizing apprenticeships might make it seem a little less risky for some of these businesses, because as I think as it stands, it's a big leap of faith for them. I mean, I know that various organisations have been doing what they can to introduce younger enthusiasts and get them into the trade, as it were. But I think, you know, moving that mindset away from everyone goes to university, I think that if you can have that paradigm shift, then maybe it'll make things a little bit easier.
I mean, I certainly agree with what Fuss said about the need for kids to know there are other opportunities out there away from education.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, looking back now, I'd probably want to go on to university had I known the apprenticeships that were out there that I could have done that would have taken me in a different route. But at the time, I didn't know that I could go into classic car restoration or I could earn a living from doing something like that. I thought if I became an apprentice, I'd end up working at a local Ford dealership, you know, changing bumpers or swapping out batteries, that sort of stuff. But to know that there's actually like a whole world out there that needs people coming into it, I think that's quite an important message to get out there.
Yeah, you obviously mentioned Fuzz Townsend there. Were there any other people that you sort of got to comment on this, or any bits that they said that didn't quite make print that sort of really stuck out to you as important lines from the industry?
Spoke to quite a few people. Usual suspects like the HCVA, spoke to Starter Motor. I also got a quote in as well from a couple of different sources, and they all said the same thing, that there is a massive need for young blood coming into the scene. Translate their apprenticeship into actually earning a living that they can then support themselves on going forward and continue in that role. So I think that's the important thing. It's not, as first said, it's not just about doing the apprenticeship. Just like that's just a small part of it. It's like carrying those skills forward and continuing your learning and then being able to support yourself.
Having those placements available after the apprenticeship is completed is the idea. I think one of the big criticisms of universities, if we're to be rather general, is that you go to university and there's no massive sort of guarantee that you'll have something at the end of it. I think that's where apprenticeships can perhaps fill the gap. If you're already, as part of your apprenticeship, going to a location and working on site, then you're gaining that experience that even if they don't then take you on board, then you can demonstrate that you can do what's required, sort of thing. It's not making that shift from something that's generally, again, I'm generalizing hugely, but, you know, based in academia to then applying it to an actual working role, sort of thing. I think the path for someone who becomes an apprenticeship is far more clear what the outcome will be potentially.
I mean, I'm certainly of an age where I went to university when we didn't have fees. You know, you got your grant or a loan and what have you, and then you went to university and basically you did 3 years of growing up, but not really. So yeah, not really the most valid experience. And I think that to know that you don't have to like leave school and then go to university and get yourself 30 grand worth of debt, and you could be earning a life skill, and then you can support yourself and have a lot of fun doing it. I think that's a really important thing for people to know.
I think the general number that's used for universities at the moment is for every job there's 140 graduate applicants for it from out of universities. So there is this sort of huge level of oversubscription, and universities aren't offering those sort of practical skills that are sort of required by the industry. So they're all, I think, yeah, the sort of opinion shift when it comes to apprenticeships needs to sort of come along, and hopefully this will sort of help change that idea of it. Because I know that Chris, you've just completed an apprenticeship. I'm on one at the moment through work. They aren't the sort of thing that you did because you can no longer get you or potentially sort of my generation always viewed the apprenticeship as something you did because you couldn't get into college, you couldn't get into university. It was just sort of the other option you did, and you tended to do it in sort of a very manual labor trade. That's sort of the generalized viewpoint my generation's had, and I think it's looking at it now from someone who is doing an apprenticeship, I think it is worth changing that viewpoint and realizing they're actually incredibly skilled things, they're valuable things that you learn, and the outcome you get when it comes to placements and sort of working fields are incredibly important, and arguably they have a greater value and probably should have a greater kudos than just a university place.
I mean, my take on having completed university and, as Jesse just mentioned, doing an apprenticeship, I mean, albeit, a good sort of 20 odd years apart, the apprenticeship path just feels so much more targeted to an outcome. I think universities try to sort of skill you to apply to as many different roles as you can, but in some ways that can potentially dilute. I mean, again, sweeping generalizations, because some university courses are very tailored to a specific outcome. But I did journalism, and I've just done journalism again, but for an apprenticeship by way of sort of upskilling myself, because I've been largely based in print and I wanted to look to produce content for different platforms as well. That's my particular take. And yeah, I don't see how a university course on classic car restoration could potentially work unless you've got that university has very close links with a series of manufacturers that can sort of place them as well. I think that's, again, I don't know, but again, the apprentices from my point of view seem like, they can be the key to sort of dealing with the skills gap in a much more sort of targeted and effective way.
It'd be interesting to hear from people who have done apprenticeships that have sort of led them into the classic world and sort of into these classic roles, and sort of see what they've learned and what they've sort of really come away with sort of knowing. I think potentially sort of, without wanting to sound like the editor, sort of making a rod for sort of James's back here and sort of saying this could be a great follow-up idea for you. But I think it'd be interesting to sort of know what the outcome from these apprenticeships is and sort of where people are going with them, that would be, and sort of really sort of showing that there is this sort of great worth to them. We'll move on to another story, another one that James sort of truffled up this week, which is the rising costs and how it's affecting show outings and sort of the pinch that clubs are feeling.
Yeah, I mean, this came about from a letter from a club, and they just sort of highlighted a few things that a few different clubs have mentioned, and I've come across quite a lot myself recently, and as much as it's the rising cost of going to shows is making it quite difficult for a lot of shows to clubs to commit to them. Obviously, we singled out the NEC as being one of them, but it's not just really the cost of the stand and everything like that. It's the general expenditure for the entire club for its individual members to have to shoulder the burden of getting a car there, taking the stand there, feeding themselves. It's the hotel expenses. It's just everything across the board has got more expensive. So a lot of clubs, sort of like the Triumph Club we spoke to, which the Triumph 2000, 2500 register, and also the Cambridge Oxford Owners Club, also the same thing. It's not about the particular show. It's just about being a bit more choosy about what they can actually commit to for the club's funds. And it's, I've spoken to quite a few people, so we only mentioned a couple in this story, but a lot of people are feeling in the pinch.
I think obviously the NEC potentially sort of gives an odd skew to it because we see so many of the clubs there. We see sort of the big stands and displays. It's sort of almost sort of it's like sort of putting on an act when you go to the doctors and sort of saying, actually, no, we're perfectly fine. But when you look at sort of smaller events where you'd expect there to be a few more car clubs and displays, often that's where you notice that there's a little less than you'd anticipate. And I think, yeah, the rising cost is an issue. Has anyone sort of come forward with a solution to it or a means of sort of working around it or finding alternative options?
Well, the Cambridge Oxford Owners Club said that if they don't attend a certain show, again, like the NEC, for example, just singling one out, if they don't attend it as a club, individual members will still go along to that because they still love the show. But what they have to then do is be a bit choosy about when they attend as a club. So if they've got a particularly interesting car for a stand, or they've got a big anniversary coming up, then they will come back, which they have done in the past, and they will do it again in the future. But having to commit year in, year out to the same thing, that's when it gets a little bit sort of like, hang on a second, can we afford to do this? And what's the value for the club? Are we going to get X amount of members? So certainly a smaller club might not attract any new members. It's not really worth them going for any particular reason. But a club like, say, an MG club, they're always going to be popular. They're always going to get new members. So it's worth the bigger clubs going. But the smaller clubs just have to be a bit more choosy about where and when they attend.
That's exactly what I was going to dip into. I mean, ultimately, if you're from a club and you're sort of in charge of the finances, there has to be reasons to be there. One reason you've just mentioned is to potentially attract, generate interest and put the brand out there and hopefully attract new members. The second one is possibly as a good meeting place for the members that do exist to come and chat, sort of thing. I just wonder whether maybe some of these smaller clubs have just found more effective ways of doing those things that doesn't involve them being at shows. It might involve them sort of talking in WhatsApp groups or on forums or things like that, and they get the same result without having to potentially spend the money that's involved, sort of thing. So I think technology is perhaps a little bit of a contributing factor here as well, in that you can get what you need in terms of that that camaraderie and that sort of social aspect. The tools that are at our disposal now allows club members to sort of, you know, organize their own meets. You don't even need potentially a particular person involved with the club to organize that. It can be very ad hoc. It can be just, you know, a message on a group of friends, say, I'm going to go to this car and coffee keep meet at the weekend. Does anyone want to come and join me? And you'll get that same effect of, you know, chatting with mates in face-to-face sort of thing. So I think you're exactly right. I think for a lot of clubs now, if they're going to be at something like the NEC, they need something that helps them stand out from the crowd, because there are an awful lot of car clubs there as well. And I mean, a lot of people will have their preferred marks and interests, sort of thing, but you still have to stand out against all the other clubs that are going to be there, sort of thing. You still have to, you know, have something that's eye-catching. If that's not there, then it's perhaps, you know, it's going to be a, you know, challenging if it is that you set your sights on achieving X number of members over the weekend, isn't it?
I mean, the great thing about a big show like the NEC as well is that, yes, certainly if a smaller club's not there one year, it might be there the following year. But the statistic that I got from the organisers is that of the 337 club stands at the show last year, 325 applied to be again there this year.
Right.
So that's 96%. So, you know, it's a rolling thing, isn't it? The show's not undersubscribed. It's always going to be busy. It's all going to attract people. But say it, who and when is going to be there keeps it fresh.
Yeah,
keeps it a little bit different. I mean, pulling on sort of experience from attending three of the Bicester Scrambles this year, at the springtime one we had, I think it was the Lancia Beta Owners Club there, and they were celebrating their anniversary. They had a huge display of cars there, and again, because it's a bigger outdoor event, they had the space to do it. And also, I think they might have been there sort of under invitation from Bicester to do it. So there wasn't sort of this, you've got to pay to sort of take part in the show. It was sort of this invitational thing, which made it all of a sudden a very reasonable thing for them to sort of get along to, very sort of easy to finance, because if you're being invited along, all of a sudden the costs aren't there for you to have to sort of stump up. Obviously they can put up their flags and everything, they can do all the usual sort of stand addenda, but it was great for them to sort of bring eyes onto the sort of Lancia Beta coupes, and they had Clarkson's one there from the last Grand Tour episode. So they had this sort of great showcase of the car, but seemingly with sort of no further strings attached to it, which was great. And a very busy public event like the Bicester Scrambles, you get all these eyes on the club, you get the sign-ups, the interactions, the appreciation of the cars without any of the added hassle. So there is sort of potentially also competition when it comes to sort of having sort of car clubs at events, when you look at the other options that are out there. And again, we saw it at the autumn one recently, the Lotus Esprit Club was there. I think the Jaguar XJS Club was there as well. So you get these sort of huge paddocks of sort of these cars and the clubs coming together, and you get a huge array of people attending sort of the Bicester Scrambles. It's not just sort of classic enthusiasts, it's car enthusiasts more broader. And the result is you get these fresh eyes onto it. And again, it's only held three times a year. They cycle through what they've got on display. It sort of really helps bring different clubs and different cars to the fore.
And actually, we did touch on it on the editorial comment about there is another option. There's the Interclub International weekend that we both went to last year, didn't we, Chris? Basically, it's a weekend where all clubs can come together and sort of spread the cost of, you know, rather than hiring a particular venue.
Yeah.
They all come together, and it's a massive showcase for, you know, hundreds of clubs.
You can't have a national that fills a massive venue, but you can if you club together with 20, 25, however many clubs it was, to make it happen sort of thing. So it gives something back to your membership who perhaps don't quite like the idea of it just being 12 of them in a hotel and maybe want to have something that's on a grander scale. It gives you that sort of option at your disposal sort of thing. It means that you're offering what you're offering to members for, you know, their membership fee is suddenly enhanced. And that was a fantastic event. I think was it last year or was it the year before last? Might have been 2023. But either way, I know it is something that the organisers are dabbling with having returned, because to all intents and purposes, everyone involved considered it to be a massive success.
So there is light on the horizon when it comes to those sort of events. We'll duck into the final little story I wanted to pull out of the news section. This is actually one that sort of semi-relates to clubs as well, which was the Transit setting a new world record at their recent Chelmsford meet as well. I think this was on page 6 of the current issue. So if you're reading along as we're chatting, turn over to page 6. I don't know if anyone does that. That'd be quite interesting to know. Obviously, we celebrated the Transit earlier this year. We had like some features on it. And I remember David and I sitting down having a chat about sort of our Ford Transit memories. But 201 Transits in one event is an incredible sort of milestone to sort of get them all back together at Chelmsford City Racecourse.
Well, apparently they had way more than that. But they were very strict on the amount of vehicles that were allowed in. They had to be actual panel vans all moving under their own steam. So I think they started with over 300 for the convoy. The actual gathering was whittled down to 201 Ford Transit, which is, say, whittled down. That's still a tremendous amount of working class vans, isn't it, to have assembled of all generations. So, and everyone who attended got a certificate from the Guinness Book of Records as well, which was quite a nice feat, all in all.
That is pretty fun indeed. I was going to say, there's a fair amount of transit, especially when you consider that sort of they were never set aside as a car or vehicle to be preserved. So for so many to sort of be restored and back on the roads and still being enjoyed and cherished it's easy to overlook the transit, I think, when it comes to the classic world.
I've never seen a transit that like it's been cherished ever. Certainly not a modern one. They all look like they're disposable, aren't they? It's like, yeah, I don't think anything's faster on the road than an empty transit.
Having driven a fair few transits, I can say that they are rarely driven in a manner that has the idea of preservation behind them, and that goes from sort of modern transits that are on the road at the moment to even when I was sort of allowed to sort of sit in the middle of the bench seat and operate the gear lever on my dad's old 2002 flatbed, which had an LPG conversion. But yeah, I remember that was never driven with any great means of care.
But it was funny because I was looking through the photos obviously to produce this feature, and there were so many sort of marks of transit or eras of transit, like all the 90s stuff. I thought, God, I remember those being everywhere. I can't remember the last time I saw like a 1990 transit anywhere outside of a show, which even then it's a rare sight, isn't it?
Like a Mark 3.
I think the last Mark 3 transit I saw probably would have been like, I think, one of the super vans that would have been at Goodwood Festival of Speed. And even then, that's sort of like a very special case when it comes to seeing a third gen transit. So that's, yeah,
incredible. My dad's had transits and has just never gone back sort of thing. He's been owning transits for the better part of sort of 15 years now. So and just they've been adapting with the various things that he's required of them. Sometimes it's been used for haulage. Sometimes it's been used for recreation, having various sort of paddle boards attached to it so that he can at the weekend go and engage in that sort of thing. But yeah, it's very sort of, I mean, these are modern transits, these aren't classic transits, but that DNA of the Transit being designed as a vehicle that could be driven like a car, I think it's very much been key to its success and key to how so many Brits have endeared themselves to it, sort of thing. You can use a Transit as an everyday vehicle. It's, you know, it's might not be for everybody, but I know that my family in particular are quite taken with that idea of having that high up seating position, viewing all of the traffic in front of them, somehow feel safer, somehow, you know, you have that observation of what's going on in sort of 5-10 cars ahead of you, sort of thing. And they just, yeah, they just see them as versatile sort of tools that they just can't do without now. So yeah, the Hope family in particular has a bit of a soft spot for Transit. So yeah, this was a great story to see.
It's kind of one of those funny things. If you don't drive a van every day for like work and you hire one, it feels like a bit of like a magical experience. It's like, God, this is, I really enjoy driving this. It's like, yeah, I'd do it more often.
I can't say, having spent a lot of time driving vans in jobs before Classic Car Weekly, that there's anything magical about driving vans. I think my best van, my best van driving experience have to be when I was a very brief period spent as a postman driving a absolutely ruined Vauxhall Combo around St Albans for a couple of shifts, and I have never experienced something that you could drive at 110% constantly and never be in fear of breaking the speed limit. But
can actually help you with that, because the post office around the corner from me has now just advertised a whole raft. I think there's like 8 or 9 Vauxhall Corsa vans, like the first generation.
Oh, wow.
And they're about £2,000 to £3,000 each. And I'm severely tempted. They're all post office red. Every time I drive past it, I think I quite like one of those, just to knock about in.
Don't do it. They will have been driven at the absolute max from cold constantly. They will never last after you drive them off of the lot. The post office has its own maintenance sort of unit that is for literally rebuilding vans that the post office drivers have trashed. Don't buy one. It's like buying an ex-police car. I'd be hesitant about doing it.
I think this is the new sort of yellow sort of Bedford CA take on life, isn't it? So the red Corsa van.
Yeah, sort of it was the Astromax van of sort of the 90s, and then it was obviously the Corsa van, and then it became the white van sort of the white Ford Transit of sort of the early noughties. They were always the ones that you were always being driven sort of on their door mirrors through sort of urban districts doing deliveries. And yeah, having experienced certainly the post office van at the limits of its traction, power delivery and braking, I can say that don't buy one secondhand. But anyway, speaking of sort of driving vehicles in a racing manner, we'll dive into Out and About in this week's issue, which actually looks ahead to 2026 and Brands Hatch, which is getting ready to celebrate its centenary. They have got something lined up called, I think it is the, let me get the page together, the Brands Hatch Centenary of Power. And I'm quite looking forward to this, actually, because I enjoy Brands Hatch. It's very close to my London Ford operating base. And they always have some absolutely brilliant classic racing events while on throughout the year. And next year, they're looking to sort of squeeze in a few extra ones as well. Motor racing legends have got a big grid coming together for a couple of events. They've tweaked and sort of retuned the Super Touring series. That's coming back again. And obviously they've got Masters racing there as well throughout the year. So there's a lot to look forward to. And yeah, I think Brands Hatch turning 100 years old is certainly something incredible indeed. Yeah. Certainly call for at least of the way we were. We must have a historic image of Brands Hatch somewhere.
Oh yeah, almost certainly. So
put it in your notebook. But no, there was a, I got a great quote, which unfortunately didn't make it into print, from Group Motorsport event manager David Wiley. Naturally, Brands Hatch's centenary year is something that has been on our mind for quite some time. This is a once in a lifetime chance for us to celebrate the circuit's heritage all season long in a special way. Given the sheer breadth of motorsports Brands Hatch has hosted over the years, it was clear to us all that a full calendar of commemorative events was the only way to go. So there is a focus on an expanded lineup of historic race meetings, not just four wheels, but also two. There is a great scene for historic motorcycle racing as well. And yeah, obviously all their big mainline events, superbikes, British touring cars will be heading along too. So yeah, I'm going to be keeping an eye on the news feed coming out of Brands Hatch. And you guys fancy taking part or heading down to any of their centenary events?
Yeah, definitely.
Long way to go, but yeah, I'd never say no.
make a weekend of it. There's some big ones. But anyway, we'll move on from sort of the news and events pages to the main feature in this week's issue, which was a really fun one, actually. Chris posited sort of a challenge to sort of pick out some cheap classics that I think all turn out to be tax exempt. And there was some interesting cars that were selected for this one, weren't there, Chris?
Yeah, I can't take credit. It was editor who wanted to sort of run this particular feature. I think we're well aware that if you're looking for value for money, that's often catered for most greatly by the modern classic scene. However, we're sort of acutely aware that if you do go down that path, you can encounter difficulties in day-to-day running, be it tax, be it the cost of insurance, particularly if you're a younger enthusiast. We're all of a mind, really, that you know, if you are looking to be as clever as you can with the money that you have available, then really you do want to look at tax exempt buy sort of thing. So we set ourselves a £5,000 limit, and we were sure to sort of, you know, back up our assertions by looking at cars that are in our own classifieds to show that they are available for that price sort of thing. And yeah, it was a really sort of eclectic mix. I mean, a lot of family favourites. I mean, it will surprise no one that James picked 1970s Beatles. But a lot of the Beatles rivals are there. You've got the Herald, you've got the Viva. But I mean, you know, there's other sort of classics as well. I mean, I thought your choice of the 190 Merc, Jesse, was quite an inspired one. That's a vehicle that always tends to be sort of underappreciated for reasons that do not make sense to me. The bargains are absolutely there sort of thing. And I was quite surprised by your other choice as well, James. I thought the days of getting Mark II Golfs were sort of long gone, but I think a lot of those sort of views are maybe sort of coloured by the number of GTIs that I see in the auction listings and in the cars for sale section. If you can find a non-GTI, a driver or something like that, then, yeah, you could potentially be quids in, couldn't you?
It's one of those things that, like, you always think automatically Golf, GTI. But then if you sort of go down a little bit further down the food chain, you get some really nice cars for the money. And actually, mm-hmm. they've got a character of their own. I mean, I think one of the most comfortable cars I ever drove was a Golf Driver with, like, a tweed interior. It was like a burgundy exterior with like a harvest gold tweed inside. And it was just so comfortable. It was a great car. And it was a friend of mine who owned it. And it was dirt cheap as well at the time. It was probably only, you know, a couple hundred, maybe a grand more now to buy that car. But even then, it was a cracking little motor that he drove every day. Not even that long ago.
I'm not going to spoil things. I think if you want to find out some of the other cars, then you should absolutely go and pick out today's issue. But what we have tried to do is give as many options as possible for those people who, it doesn't have to be, it wasn't especially aimed at younger enthusiasts. It can be just those who are keen to expand their collections, but maybe don't have the most money to spend. We were just trying to get people's money to go further sort of thing, picking out something that's fun to drive and straightforward to look after. And also, you know, isn't going to sort of, you know, feel like yet another sort of Netflix or Amazon subscription in terms of the outgoings every month. Hopefully, you know, you can look after it yourself, and it's not going to prove to be too expensive.
Mm. I mean, without spoiling any of the cars that are in the selection, what I found most interesting was that actually all cars, if you were to look back through all of our history, we've either all owned or have aspired to. I think most of these cars we've owned, looking at the list. So it's not just a case of like plucking a random bunch of cars for £5,000 out. It's actually, yeah, we'd all own these.
Comes from our own experience.
Yeah.
And when it comes certainly to sort of young people getting into classics, I think I can count there's at least five of the cars in this list. So half of them I know are currently owned by sort of young people that I know of in the sort of the classic scene. So it proves that there is sort of, certainly when it comes to my generation, this interest in these older cars. I think the Mercedes really is sort of the top end of that age bracket. And again, that's sort of really finding its feet with my generation, getting into classic cars, getting something that's a little bit different, but usable and drivable. But I know there's obviously loads of people in the Midget Sprite Club that have got the 1500 Midgets because they're the cheaper ones to get hold of. But mm-hmm. I spoke to two people across the weekend at the Bicester Scramble that have got Triumph Heralds. Again, another someone who's about my age works as a machinist over at one of the motorsports sort of shops there, and she absolutely loves her Triumph Herald. And again, it just sort of goes to show that the affordable end of the market is really sort of is being kept alive a bit by sort of the younger people and these sort of more left field choices when it comes to buying classics, because they are sort of the forgotten ones. They aren't the top spec ones, the high performing ones, and they're enjoyed, which is nice. But yeah, it's a fun feature and one I enjoyed putting together, and also sort of waiting for it to appear on the system so I could read everyone else's choices and what they thought of it. Certainly when it came to sort of Mike's argument for the 1500 midget, as he beat me to the punch on that selection. But
Yes.
yeah, because obviously he's had one previously as well, so it's always interesting to sort of pick apart his thoughts on them and his enjoyment. But there we go. It is a brilliant feature, and it is tucked in alongside a lot of other top tier content. We've got a five trials of the MGB Roadster, the later issue ones with the rubber bumpers, again keeping it in that 5k bracket, and a buying guide for the Citroën C6 2005 through 2012. And again, terrifyingly, I can remember the original Top Gear road test of this when it was on television, and now seeing that appearing in the classic titles makes me feel unerringly old. But yeah, plenty to pick up and enjoy in this week's issue. And obviously, we ought to go and crack on with producing next week's, because we're into bumper issue territory now, I think.
Yes. Next issue on sale, October 15th, is an upsized pagination. It's themed around autumn, but there's a big focus on various sort of value for money classics. This is an issue, one of our issues in the year where we run a full price guide, which is definitely worth a look. Again, loads of surprises there with in terms of what it costs to actually buy cars. You will be sort of hopefully in a good way surprised by the affordability of some of the cars that we've got included there. We've gone through various auction listings throughout the year, cars for sale. We draw upon various sources. So yeah, again, have a look through that. Be fantastic to get some thoughts on what you think is the cars that we should be sort of focusing on going forward.
A lot to look forward to. Otherwise, gents, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And we'll go and crack on with the next issue of Classic Car Weekly.